Hello, listeners. I'm Logan McLean, and this is OJT, On the Job Training. It's a podcast where I, a rookie journalist, practice my craft by interviewing passionate people about their projects. Natasha Penteluk is a scientist, nature enthusiast, and recent master's graduate. Before her academic work, Penteluk had a long background in research and education. We talk today about how she got into science and exploration, why she enjoys working with kids, and how that brought her to her master's work. And listen after the interview for this month's progress report, where I talk about my efforts to become more professional with my photography. Okay, Natasha Penteluk, welcome to OJT.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So you're a master's student doing some cool science stuff, and we're going to get into that. But first, I wanted to just talk a bit about you and kind of how you got into the love of science and nature and conservation, that kind of stuff.
Oh, gosh, how did I get into it? Well, I think I've always had an intense love and curiosity for finding out how and why the kind of like the web of everything around us works. So I think ever since childhood, this manifested in like a passion for psychology, biology, and just spending time reveling in nature, as I think most kids kind of do. And then that kind of paired with how I was raised in scouting and with my dad hunting, it really just seems like a natural transition that I ended up in wildlife biology with, you know, a behavioral twist, as it ended up being.
So it's a lifelong kind of thing. You said scouts?
Kind of like Boy Scouts, but in Canada, it's co-ed. And it's basically like the community I was raised in was always going camping, doing things outdoors, just spending time being a wild child outside sort of thing, which is, I think, so important for so many people. And that sort of like ethos of adventure, I think, really, really affected how I grew up and kind of how I try to live today as well.
As an adult now in a very connected electronic kind of world, are you grateful for having had that sort of childhood?
So much. Yeah, for sure. I think it is really important. Even now, you know, today I live in the city and technology is such a huge part of my life. With my research, sure, there is a summer of field work, but it's all on a computer. And I mean, especially in this day and age with the pandemic going on, some of us are so intensely online all the time. And I don't even really do social media. So the fact that I feel like I'm online all the time is a lot. And it's something that I want to get more into also going forward, how I shape my life, my goals. It's sort of about getting even more into that, really getting out into nature and building a life and structuring it so that the default is not being online.
So you mentioned where you are a couple times. I should fill listeners in on this. You're currently in Alberta, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I was born and raised in Edmonton, Alberta. And then I went and did my undergrad at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Came back to Edmonton, did another summer in Nova Scotia. And now I'm back in Edmonton doing my master's.
Was that a good place for those kinds of outdoorsy pursuits when you were a kid? And now, I guess, too?
You know, I have to say, I don't think it matters all that much. I was in the city, and a city is a city. We had to go outside of the city to really do a lot of the real nature-y things that I have so many fond memories of. And I think that's really possible anywhere. If anything, actually being in a place that is so cold for the winter, and I really don't handle cold well, as much as I try to be a tough cookie, cold's pretty difficult for me. And I sometimes wish that I was in a place that had, you know, a little bit more approachable weather, perhaps, for more of the year. But, you know, there is lots of crown land, which is really, really great. You know, unlike a lot of places in the world, you can drive for hours and not see anybody. All it is will be like every once in a while an oil rig in the middle of nowhere. And that's really, really nice to just be able to go out and it's no one's property. It's just crown land. It's just wide open spaces to kind of have fun and do whatever, which is really nice.
PEI has almost no crown land.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, it's one of those things, and I've never really thought about until I went to Nova Scotia and was basically just like, you know, surrounded in a place where there's more, not necessarily people, because like obviously Alberta has like more people, and it's like there's denser, bigger cities. But, you know, you can drive for a long time and there is nobody. And versus when you're Nova Scotia, you go for 20 minutes and it's another house, which I guess they're calling another town. And it's, which is very, very different. Here you can just go out and be completely alone pretty fast and kind of just do whatever you want for the most part.
You can hunt on Crown Land, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. Obviously, you still need a license and stuff, but...
Yes. Yeah. No. I don't. I've never really talked to many people that are hunters in places where you have to like do you. The default is having to always do the getting permission from people. Although that being said, where my partner hunts now and where I've done like duck hunting and stuff are all in places where it was either permission or was land bought by kind of various trusts that buy the land to keep it nice for nature but also for hunting. It's an interesting thing for sure.
I just realized something. We didn't do a clap sync, so can I get you to hold your headphones up to your mic?
Okay.
They're there. Okay. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. That should be good.
Should that be good?
Yeah, it should be fine.
Okay.
Oh, glad I remembered that. That's the key. Get home and go, oh my God, we're talking in two different time zones.
Oh, shit.
So, you grew up in Alberta, got into science, nature, conservation just from people you were around. You were in scouts with your father. And you said you went to university at Dalhousie. That's where we met, actually. Tell me a little bit about kind of the decision to pursue this stuff in university and make a career out of it.
I always knew I was going to be a scientist. And when I say I always, as in like when I was in kindergarten, when people asked what I was going to be, I said either an astronaut, an actress, a singer, or a neuropsychologist. So
I just picture little Natasha saying no psychologist.
What was that?
I just picture little Natasha saying no psychologist.
Yes. Yeah, no, exactly. and you know, I found out what like genetics are, and like when I was in junior high, Michael Crichton was like my favorite author, and you know, all that sci-fi stuff that just, you know, still gets, I think, any reasonable person pretty stoked. I really got into all that sort of stuff and the nitty gritty of it. And it's kind of funny. Like my mom is a psychologist, and focuses on like learning and learning disabilities and things like that. And I think that I partially didn't want to go into psychology just because my mom's a psychologist. You never want to do exactly what your parents do. But that sort of like breed of things, looking at like biology and nature and living things and living systems, but also the deep whys of what's going on behind it and how everything's interacting to create those things. That's where the fascination was. And I wanted to like, you know, spread my wings a bit, go somewhere else. And the East Coast really appealed to me. And I know I wanted to do some sort of like hands-on biology of some sort. And I kind of just fell in love with the ocean. Of course, being a prairie girl, there is always a romantic pull to the ocean.
Yeah, I wanted that.
Yeah. And so doing marine biology at Dalhousie really just felt like the perfect fit. So I ended up doing that and had an absolute blast, and then got a minor in psychology at the same time, kind of looking at a lot of kind of marine animal behavior was at the time what I was looking at. And yeah.
Yeah, you told me all of the interesting shark facts that I know I got from you. The thing about their skin being made is the same stuff as their teeth, and it just keeps pushing back. That's how they have so many teeth. That's keep you up at night.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I, sharks are pretty awesome. That's for sure.
So you've mentioned a couple times now that you like to know how things work. Why is that?
Oh gosh. I mean, I think we all do to varying extents. It's just, I don't know. I can't imagine my brain existing in a state that doesn't want to know. You know, I can't imagine, or goodness, I'd have a lot of trouble trying to imagine what it feels like to have something be happening. And obviously, there's complex things leading to what we're witnessing, and not wondering what those systems are. I can't fathom what that apathy would feel like to have.
There are people who are like that, though. Have you always been so curious?
Yeah, I'd say so. I don't think I've ever really wavered in that. I mean, sometimes you don't have the energy to ask all the questions, but I don't think I've ever actually become apathetic and not wondered, at least on some scale.
How did that play out in the public school system? Sometimes the kid with all the questions gets told to just shut up and read the book.
You know, it's, for the most part, it was good. I had a lot of really great teachers growing up, and went to a fairly small elementary school, only 200 kids for all of elementary, which is small, I think, for a school in the city. And we had, I had really good teachers, and I cared so much about learning, and I've always kind of been a suck up and like to please authority figures. So my enthusiasm and my willingness to please, I think, got me pretty darn far in terms of my comfortability in the school system. I think I was far more comfortable in the public school system than a lot of people. Which I'm thankful for myself. Although I do pity the people where it didn't work out quite as well. The only times that I would have issues is that I always see things and I'm thinking about things kind of complexly, like what are the reasons behind it, what's leading to what, and that always kind of screwed me over when it came to multiple choice, because if there's a specific answer, but if you, I could technically maybe justify why the other answer is correct. I'd work myself into a tizzy, and then I'd select the wrong answer. Now, if the questions were always just asked in short answer format or long answer format, I'd always get it right because I'd be justifying the process and the whole picture of how I think of how something works. But it's funny. Everybody says like, "Oh, it's just a multiple choice test; it'll be easy." But I did horrible multiple choice tests, and that really paid. I paid the price in my marks in university until like third year when you actually started getting short answer exams, and I was good from there on in. But multiple choice is the bane of my existence.
If you have any like underlying anxiety, you can think your way into all four of those answers for sure, unless it's super super clear. But
exactly, and I totally would. Yeah, I'd work.
And because you're not like a purely black and white thinking kind of person, you have a philosophical side. So I could see you sitting there at a desk, stroking your beard and pounding your forehead. Which one is it? It's all of them.
That is very accurate.
So on that note, then, you went to Dalhousie after high school, and did you immediately know what you were going to take? I think you came for the oceans and whale stuff and the shark stuff. What about the psychology side and other things?
I actually throughout kind of high school and early junior high, I got really obsessed with genetics. Like genetics was where it was at for me. That's where my huge passion was. I loved it. I had my mom teach me like the different phases of like cellular mitosis and meiosis, like in bed with her with an old textbook she had from when she was university in the 80s. I love that.
Tell me about the telo phase again, mama.
Exactly. And I went to, so even though I really liked, I had this sort of warring sides where my passion was genetics and like more intellectually, but like in terms of the lifestyle I wanted a bit more of that stereotypical field work, marine biologist, out in the sun, like that sort of thing. And when I actually got to university, it turns out that as much as I do still love genetics, I like to hear about it and hear the cliff notes, I think, more than anything. I like other people to do the hard work of all the boring stuff in the lab. And then I get to just, you know, read the abstracts of the papers once the hard work's done. So I kind of moved away from that side of it. And then, and as I said, I think I was kind of ignoring the fact that I had this psychology side to me when I first started. And then I was like, oh, I'll just take a psychology class. It'll be a science credit. And I think it was also going to be my like social science credit. And I was like, oh, and maybe it'll be a bit easier. And I really liked it. And there's some really cool animal behavior researchers at Dalhousie, both in the kind of the marine side, but also in other fields. And I just kind of kept on taking classes until I was like, oops, I have a minor. And yeah, it kind of just happened organically that I ended up getting more and more into the psychology end of things, as well as really, of course, enjoying the ecology side of marine biology.
Yeah, I remember that process of you getting more into psychology. You took some statistics as well, right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's oh man, looking back there. Okay, so statistics were not my favorite.
Yeah, I was trying to remember if you hated it or kind of liked it. Or
it totally depended on the professor. I went between hating it, having be my worst subject, and then I had one teacher teach a class, and I loved her, and I was like, I'm going to get a minor in statistics. And then I switched, I had a different teacher again for the next sort of part of the class, and I was like, never mind, I hate this. But in retrospect, having done my master's now, though, it's one of those things where not only... Because they say that if you're going to continue on with research, not that I necessarily was even thinking of doing that at the time, but I wanted the door open for me. If you're going to continue on with research, you need good statistics. And that's true. But there was, in reality, one thing that was glossed over at Dalhousie, at least for me and my experience and the path that I took, was that I didn't know how to do R. And R is a programming language where you do all of your statistics, where you keep all of your data sets. It's where you do anything, all of your analysis. And I didn't know how to do R. And unfortunately, at the University of Alberta, there's not really many opportunities to learn how to do it either. So I had to teach myself. And it's one of those things where, out of all the skills that I wish I had gotten from my undergraduate degree, there's a lot of holistic ones I'm glad I did, but in terms of concrete skills, I can't believe that I came out of a minor in any sort of STEM field without knowing how to use a programming language like R.
Yeah, that sounds like a bit of a failing, like they taught you almost outdated tools.
Yeah, and I mean, it was good that I was learning, like, you know, how to do it by hand, which is good, because that means I knew the actual statistics we're doing, which I think a lot of people don't know. Not that I completely remember, but I technically was taught that at some point. Yeah, it's one of those things where it used to be something. I mean, having everybody know how to do programming was not something that all the professors even do today. Like, it is not new, but it's, yeah. And unfortunately now it's just, yeah, everybody knows how to do it. And for me, my master's project has ended up being a little bit more social sciences than I anticipated when I first thought about doing a master's. And in social science, they used to do this program called SPSS, and it works quite well for certain things, but they're really moving away from that and towards R as well. So you get a lot of people from the social sciences as well as like older professors that are kind of begrudgingly either having to learn R, or they're just clinging on to SPSS, or, you know, there's there's a lot of changes and adaptations that's having to happen within a lot of academia around how we manage our data and how we do our analysis. And yeah, there's a lot of changes going on regarding that.
So have you been able to learn it yet?
Yes. Yeah, I am. It was like pulling teeth, but I eventually, really, I should probably get my degree from the internet and Stack, which is a website that I use all the time to learn how to do code. But yeah, it was a lot of just kind of going through. My partner, he's in IT and he's not a developer, but he does know how to code basically. And having somebody, even though like he doesn't, like R is like a language, and there's lots of different languages for coding. And once you know one, it's kind of like knowing a romantic language. Like if you know Spanish, your time learning French is going to be a lot easier. So once you know how to code one language, you can learn another language pretty easy. So he helped me a lot. And how transferable coding skills are is really mind-blowing too. Like I learned how to do R, which was just using all of my data sets and learning how to manipulate them and apply statistics and use packages and functions and all that other fancy stuff. And I tried my hand at coding a website, and with kind of minimal assistance, I was able to code an entire website for myself as well. So coding is a really useful skill, and it is super transferable to lots of different things.
That's the website with your CV on it, right?
Yeah.
The pile of accolades and accomplishments.
Yes, well, I needed somewhere to put them.
So modest, so humble. I'm so accomplished, I have to build my own website to tell people I built my own website full of my accomplishments.
It's so true, yes. Yep, that is an accurate portrayal.
Well, I got a Squarespace, who I will continue to shout out in hopes that they will one day sponsor this podcast.
It's a good technique.
Their drag and drop technology can't be beat. So we can move forward a little bit. Start talking a bit about, maybe we should stick at Dal just for a second. You got to graduate a little bit early, right? By putting in quite a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, I probably took too many courses in my first little while. You know, it's one of those things where you are used to your placement on the bell curve in, you know, high school or whatever. And I was used to being able to do the workload that they offered. If they offered a certain workload, I was able to do it. And so when I got to university, I was like, oh, 5 courses is like the like full-time, full, you know, that they offer. I can do 5. Really, I shouldn't have done 5. There's no reason for that. Like my piece of advice for anyone is just like, don't push yourself. Err on the side of not doing as many courses as you think you can do. So I did that, and especially in the beginning, I took too many courses at a time. I took too many science courses. Like I said, I had an opportunity to take like basically any course I wanted in order to do a social science credit, and I took psychology, which of course I don't regret. I love psychology, but at the same time, I was like, I could have taken something in philosophy and really enriched and well-rounded, made my experience at university that much more well-rounded. And then my writing course, I took an interviewing ocean scientist, which again, great course, but really I could have taken, you know, a creative writing course instead. The other reason why I was able to graduate early is I did summer courses that were compressed and hands-on courses in various areas. And those were the best academic experience of my life. They were like a full credit course compressed into like 2 weeks, and they were all hands-on. We were just totally immersed in the content. Like one of them was marine ornithology, and we traveled to Grand Manan Island in the Bay of Fundy, and we created and kind of set up our own study, and we got to go around all these different islands and ID birds, and we stayed in it overnight in this lighthouse that was just gorgeous. And like, that's how education's supposed to be. It was amazing. And it really reignited my passion for these things. At the end of 3 years, you kind of, you know, as passionate as I am, it it kind of starts to kill you a bit, you know, being stuck in these 300 people classrooms and doing these multiple choice exams. I really treasure those experiences doing those summer courses because they were a reminder of what it could be and why I like doing these things.
Sounds a little bit like it would be a bit of a trip back to what got you into it in the first place, too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was really great. Because like I said before, I don't think I did that poorly in the public school system of, like, you know, grade school and everything. That worked okay. I had some really great teachers. Classes were only 45 minutes long or an hour anyway. And, you know, I did IB as well in high school. So there's lots of ways to make it engaging. But that I can't really always say the same when I got to university. That it really starts to become really, really challenging. And I just wish I could have done my whole degree in those summer courses that were hands-on.
You said you did IB in high school. What's that? People around here wouldn't know.
Oh, yeah. It's International Baccalaureate. So it's kind of like an advanced placement, but it's more about seeing the connection between all the topics and going deeper and talking about the whys. Like, advanced placement normally is just like making the content harder, but making it harder is a byproduct, but it's also, trying to get more in depth with the content. And it's a international program that like lots of schools do around the world. So I just had some of my courses I did IB, not all of them, but yeah. And it's, I think Nova Scotia does it. Maybe that might be a rumor, but I think there's some universities in Nova Scotia. I mean, high schools in Nova Scotia that do it as well.
Three Oaks damn sure did not do it. Get your interdisciplinary ideas out of here. We're learning the math book. Rote memorization. Don't ask me why. I don't know.
I think I remember having like people. I also went to an art school for junior high and high school. So I had like some kids do interpretive dance interpretations as their essays on like a political journalism piece or something. You know, it had its fun moments for sure.
Yeah, that sounds pretty sweet, actually. From what it sounds like, you are someone who appreciates education and not just like memorizing stuff, like with that, you know, curiosity that you have, the need to know why. And especially what you mentioned with those courses at Dal that you got so much out of. Like, I bet, I'm only assuming here, but somehow I bet you don't remember the grades you got on those courses, but you clearly remember some strong memories and learning a lot.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things where when I started to realize how multiple choice exams, which are the majority of the exams I got through for most of university, weren't capturing what I knew. Like, I was sometimes tutoring friends in class, and then I'd get like 10% lower on them in the exam because it was multiple choice. Like, I really, you know, started to try to differentiate myself between my performance and how I feel about the class or the subject matter. I mean, to this day, one of the worst marks I ever got in university was cell biology, but it's also one of the most fascinating courses I've ever taken, just in terms of raw material. Like, that stuff's off the wall. I did horrible in it, though. Yeah. I mean, education is super important to me. When, like, in my undergraduate degree, I started working occasionally as a natural history interpreter in various jobs and situations, basically doing educational outreach with youth and other members of the public. And actually, for a year after I finished my undergraduate degree, when I moved back to Alberta, I worked full time at a nature center and plant conservatory here in Edmonton. And it was an amazing job of just interacting with the public and igniting and spreading passion and curiosity. It was fantastic. And in fact, if it wasn't for the lack of upward mobility in the places where I was working, I wouldn't be surprised if I'd still be there today and I would have never done the master's, but there wasn't really any opportunity for me to move up and move forward. So I ended up going to different chapters in my life.
What kind of things did you do there?
I did, they have like a lot of the sort of the business for the Nature Center and Plant Conservatory I was at was have schools would come in various grades, and they asked for a program on different things. So, you know, little kids would have programs on pollinators, and I'd take them around our interpretive room, and I'd show them different sort of pieces from our archives. I'd go on, take them on walks, talk about pollinators. For the older kids, we'd be talking about aquatic ecology in our little pond, and we'd be looking for critters, and we'd be talking about how humans interact with nature as well. And I also did and those were programs that people would schedule. Normally schools would schedule. But we also did just walk-in stuff as well. Like we have a little interpretive room and people would come in, or people would be walking to the nature center. And if it was just my kind of like paid free time, I'd take them on walks around the nature center grounds or the plant conservatory and be talking about the different sort of things that can be pointed out. Sometimes we'll just be going exploring, see what we can find, what sort of species are out there. Or maybe I'd go out there more pointedly talking about just talking about the role of like interspecies relationships, things like that. I also, for a period of time, was a supervisor there. So in that situation, I was doing some more kind of program creation as well around what we want to do in those places. But it was also like just more holistically, it was going on a journey with myself and my coworkers and figuring out how to get people excited, or if they are excited, how to figure out what that excitement is about and how to join them in that excitement, and really just foster that curiosity and enjoyment and appreciation of the natural world around us.
How does it feel to share that kind of stuff, especially with younger people?
Incredibly fulfilling. Incredibly fulfilling. There's nothing really like it. It's, I think parents and teachers that have been really involved with like the exploration of children will say that it's incredibly rewarding to feel like you're being a guide into a whole new world almost. And it's amazing when they come away with a different perspective. Like we had garter snakes in the nature center's kind of one of the interpretive rooms, and I remember this these two parents came in with their little girl, and the mom was quite scared of snakes. A lot of parents are, and the little girl at first looked at the snake, didn't really react at all, was just like, "Oh, cool." And then she saw the mom's reaction and she started to tense up. And that's what I see most of the time is if I'm, you know, using the snake as an interpretive tool, before I bring to the room, I ask the parents if any of the parents have any adverse reaction at all to leave the room, not even just stand on the side and don't do anything, just leave the room because they'll pick up on it. But then the mom left and I spent some time with the snake and the little girl and getting her to, you know little Reggie, and I did a feeding of Reggie, and I talk to her about snakes and how cool they are and how interesting they are and how amazing they are. And she got so excited, and eventually she ran back to her mom and she was like, "You have to come see the snake. He's a good snake." And how that was a really, you know, and situations like that happened all the time, or, you know, with kids when they would scream when they saw a bug because they learned that somewhere. And I'd tell them that like they had it was a 1 second rule I'd have, is that if you scream within the first second of seeing the bug, that's okay, because that was an instinct. I'm not going to blame you for it. But if you pause and then scream, we're going to have to talk about it, because I'm not about that life. And just trying to make people feel like they can enjoy every part of everything that's out there.
Did it feel a little bit like giving back? I know you mentioned having so many good teachers yourself.
I've never really thought about it as like giving back per se. I mean,
maybe not like, giving back so much as continuing a positive cycle.
Yeah, I think the having kids be comfortable and curious in nature and science and about really anything is the gift that keeps on giving. And the alternative to that, you know, when I say like it as an act that is done, it can almost seem like, oh, something that you can choose to do. But the alternative to that is allowing fear or apathy or not caring or allowing a natural curiosity to die or actively prohibiting its bloom. And that is just, you know, that's just not good at all. That's damaging. And it's just part of being a human, I think. You know, not that everybody has to have a passion about the exact same thing, but making sure that you're not actively creating barriers to someone's curiosity and passion is important. And once you do that, once kids feel that, then it's really their ability to interact with the world with a sense of opportunity is able to affect every part of their life. And I'm saying kids because, you know, they're at a malleable age and that's who I interacted with a lot during those years. But it is everybody as well. You know, there's always an opportunity for people to change how they perceive something or how they feel when they're around it. And yeah, I think it's the healthy thing to do.
It's just easier with kids, right?
Yeah, they're not coming into it with as many biases. And also, I mean, kids are just as smart as adults. They don't necessarily always have as much of a background of knowledge. But as long as you back up far enough to where you're talking about the concepts that they need to know in order to know the next one, they can understand just as much as adults do. Like,
absolutely.
And you'll find that sometimes they'll even understand things faster than adults do because they're not carrying in their own baggage around the topic.
Yeah, exactly. They don't have all this baggage and preconceptions, and they're not jaded, bitter old people like we are fast becoming. Well, you're clearly not, Natasha.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. And like how many times parents would think that the kids would react a certain way, or they'd be like, oh, that topic's too big. You know, it didn't happen all too often. I don't want to act like parents are walking around being like, don't teach my kid anything. It's not really it. But for example, we had some of the interpretive supplies we normally do in these courses and stuff. We'd sit in a big circle with all the kids and we'd bring out things to pass around so they can look at them. And we had a whole moose leg. Like fur on it and everything. The meat was like kind of plasticized, but it was a whole moose leg, and you looked in the top and you see the bone, the flesh, and the fur. Like it wasn't like nicely taxidermied clothes, so there's no view of the inside. And I take it out and the parents would be like, oh my gosh, and the kids would always be like, whoa, what is, I'd explain what it is, and they'd say, did it die? And I'd say, yeah.
No, he's still out there.
And they'd be like, oh, did you kill it? And I'd say, no, we don't collect our own specimens. They're like, well, did the person that got it from kill it? And I said, I don't know. And the parents would be like, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to talk? And the kids are just shrugging, like, okay. Like kids aren't incompetent. They know things die.
Yeah.
And how we, you know, sheltering them from all these things. It's not like I was going to have a whole conversation about, like, you know, the what happens after you die. Like, I wasn't there for that. But you don't have to get into that to just show somebody a dead moose leg. Like, the kids can handle it. They're fine.
Well, and if you're going to learn about life, you kind of have to learn about death too.
Yes, yeah. And it cycles, and it's amazing stuff. And yeah, it was, they were able to handle so much and do so much as long as they didn't pick up on apprehension from the people they were looking up to.
I've heard it said that every kid is a natural-born scientist. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's totally true. I mean, like, if we're saying, like, that it's one of those things where with what a scientist is, you know, there's, like, the occupation. But I think when people say that, they're also talking about, like, the lifestyle and thought process of asking questions and being curious and trying to get answers and just, you know, being little investigators. And I think that's totally true. Encouraging questions to be asked and also saying you don't know when you don't know, I think is something that I always have to remind myself is okay as well. Because when you say you don't know, it also is an opportunity to find out. And that can be really exciting for kids to hear as well. So not only is it okay that you, if you don't know something, but isn't it so cool that even like adults that are like authority figures, like that they don't know something, maybe eventually I can find out. And that's cool. And that's exciting. And that's okay.
Yeah. It's a good thing to not know everything. God, it would ruin your soul to know everything.
Exactly. It'd be very boring.
And like you said, it's just an opportunity to learn.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, there's lots of kids that, you know, weren't scared of the outdoors, but they just, it wasn't really their thing. And they'd interact and do things out there. Like, you know, I don't want to make it sound like, oh, if it wasn't for all of us messing with everything, every single kid would be just, you know, out there being little, I don't know, Reagan muffins in the mud. No, a lot of them probably would. But, you know, I'm not, it's that the removing the barriers to that and having curiosity, however that manifests itself, however the kid is naturally comfortable doing, is important to facilitate.
Yeah, I think that idea is less about every kid being out in the woods with a magnifying glass and a notebook and more about that curiosity and that willingness to admit, I don't know this, maybe I'll go find out.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's it for part one with Natasha Penteluk. She'll be back soon, though, to get into just what her master's research is all about. Until then, here's the progress report. Today, I want to talk a bit about my halfway mark at The Guardian, and then more about my renewed efforts to be a halfway decent photographer. It's now been over 3 months of working at The Guardian. 3 months of real journalism life. And I've got to say, I love it. I still have days and sometimes weeks where things feel off the rails, but I'm at a point where it makes enough sense that I know now what's going on around me, and most of what my role is. Maybe more important than just understanding, though, I'm finally believing that I'm pretty good at this. With the positive feedback piling up, it's hard to ignore that I'm reaching the right people. I've actually started moving all those nice emails to a separate folder, or, you know, copy and pasting social media comments into an email and then moving them over. Like many people, I will too easily ignore a mountain of pluses for a single noisy minus. So I really need that "you're doing a great job" stuff near at hand. Now, that doesn't mean I'm getting complacent. Far from it. As I've talked about before, I'm always looking to learn and grow, and journalism has endless opportunities for that. Last summer, I started finally getting into photography. There's some progress reports about it, but I'm not sure which ones. You'll just have to go looking through last summer's episodes. Lately, I've been practicing photography outside on my days off. I've got a pretty decent backyard at this apartment, with the usual variety of birds, bees, and trees. So I'm learning to identify backyard nature stuff. There's actually a lot more variety than I realized, but that's a progress report for another time. I want to get actually good at photography. Having impactful pictures makes such a difference and helps stories reach a wider audience. Not everyone reads 600 to 800 words easily, especially with a busy schedule, but visual learners might be more driven to read if they have those stimulating images. That picture being worth 1,000 words thing is only true if it's a good shot. It's always worth some words, but they may not be the ones I want without some practice. One area I've really been working on, by which I mean repeatedly screwing up and having to learn more about, is direct sunlight photography, especially at midday. Many of my interviews are right around noon, and none of them are during the golden hours after sunrise and before sunset. This leads to a lot of weird shadows and squinty faces, especially now that it's June. Apparently, lens filters will help with some of the lighting color issues, along with some technique and location framing things, but I can't say that I've got it yet. One thing that is working is a new technique I learned for blurring the background of portrait shots, the kind of thing I take a lot when I meet people at, say, a coffee shop. In those cases, the background is often just a distraction at best, and ruins the picture at worst. So, being able to get rid of that, along with getting a feel for vertical shots, is making a difference. I've also picked up a new telephoto zoom lens, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. 55 to 250 millimeter on my Canon Rebel SL2 for camera nerds. I tried to be as mobile as possible while doing photography to get more dynamic shots, but there are some things that just aren't possible without serious zoom. Beyond that, it's great for being discreet at, say, a Mi'kmaq Catholic church service like the one I went to in May. Now that I'm feeling less and less overwhelmed in this gig, I feel like I can finally focus more on improving my craft and doing the little things that get contracts renewed. More on that later. Natasha Penteluk will be back soon to get into her master's research on invasive fish. In the meantime, check out her CV on the website she built herself, natashalin.ca. Natasha also suggested listeners check with their local governments for invasive species in their area. You could follow this podcast on Instagram at @OJT_podcast and on Twitter at @OJTpodcast. You can follow me on Instagram at logan.mclean.75 and on Twitter at loganmclean94. And finally, listeners, please check out my website, OJTpod.ca, for my written stories and photography. The podcast is available there and on all major streaming platforms. Please rate and subscribe and leave a review. Everything helps when getting a podcast off the ground, and if you like this show and want more interesting guests, listener feedback is the best way to help me reach new people and make that happen. This has been OJT, On the Job Training. I'm Logan McLean. Thank you for listening.